Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. The political junkie will join us at the top of the 10 o'clock hour. Now we're in depth on what repealing the Affordable Care Act means for health care in America.
Obamacare is going to be repealed and replaced. Obamacare is a disaster.
That's candidate Donald Trump on 60 Minutes last fall, embracing the Republican doctrine that has existed since the day the ACA was signed into law, repeal Obamacare. Now, with control of the presidency, Senate and House, Republicans have the capability to do that, but they've been much less clear about what they'd replace it with. Remember that although parts of the Affordable Care Act remain deeply controversial, parts of it are pretty acceptable to Americans, and we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about the future of individual state exchanges, and we're going to talk about why healthcare prices and premiums may continue to rise whatever the GOP comes up with. So as our guests join us this morning, I'd like you to think about what works and what doesn't in your healthcare plan. Is the deductible too high? Are your choices too limited? How has the Affordable Care Act served you so far? So this is for everyone. Whether you get your health care from your employer, whether you get it through the exchange, I want to hear about what works and what doesn't in your health care plan. So if you find yourself with a plan that you get from your employer and your deductible is too high, talk to us about that. Are your choices too limited? Do you like what you have? You can talk to us about that this morning. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, and we're online with a conversation, mprnews.org/live. Steve Parente is back in the studio with me. He's the chair of the Health Finance Program at the Carlson School. I have a feeling we'll be seeing a lot of each other, Steve, in the next few months. So welcome back. It's good to have you on the show.
Happy to be here, Carrie.
Sally Pipes is with us. She's CEO of the Pacific Research Institute and author of The Way Out of Obamacare. And she's with us from L.A. And Sally, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Sally, is it right to say that many of the problems that existed with our health care system before the Affordable Care Act still exist? I made reference to these rising health care costs, uneven standards, costs of care around the country. We had dissatisfaction before. We still have it after the ACA. Is that true?
It absolutely is true. And I think we saw in the election, you meant in the preamble to the show, you played Donald Trump at the GOP convention in July. And then just, you know, on November 1st, he made that big speech in Valley Forge saying that he would have a special session after inauguration to immediately repeal and replace Obamacare. I think the American people are upset with Obamacare. The exit polls showed that. And so we have a lot of problems, as you mentioned. And then the other issue is that the administration thought that young people, the young invincibles, would sign up, you know, in droves, and they were supposed to make up 40% of the market, and they only made up 28%. So a lot of the problems we're seeing, you know, today are because insurance companies are pulling out, the co-ops that have failed, et cetera.
Steve, this is something we talked about when you were on the show before the election, which is the risk pool did not balance because we didn't have enough young people signing up. Why wasn't there enough of an incentive for them to sign into this?
In part because of the research that was done to show what the blueprint for the Affordable Care Act was, which really was Massachusetts. So John Gruber and several other folks that were really playing a key role in that found that if you had just a very small penalty for the individual mandate, that would be enough of a nudge. Turns out it was probably too small of a nudge to get people to go, and the individual mandate was held back at first. That's one of the major reasons. And the other thing, too, is that the premiums were probably just too pricey. I mean, when I model this stuff out, premium or price drives a lot of what the conclusions are. And if you make something too expensive, people aren't going to come to it.
Sally, why were the premiums so high? Does it have anything to do with the fact that the insurers underestimated the cost that they were going to incur through this and weren't ready for being part of these exchanges?
Well, exactly. I think that, you know, the insurance company, back in 1993, 94, when HillaryCare was around, the insurance companies really fought that. But with Obamacare, they bought into it. I think they thought they were going to get a lot of new customers. And, of course, you know, we've really, in 2016 so far, it looks like 11.1 million people have signed up on the exchanges. 85% of them getting subsidies from the federal government. But they priced, I think, I don't know, but I think they priced the plans in the beginning low, and because they wanted to attract people. Mm-hmm. But in fact, when they found out how many people signed up and the fact that these people were older and sicker, put a lot of pressure on them. And then we saw that the young people that are supposed to cover in the risk pool, the older and sicker, had not signed up. And so, you know, that's why we're seeing that for 2017, when the I call it the October surprise, when they announced the premium increases of the 39 states on healthcare.gov, they're up 25%. And for those in the remaining 11 states that have their own exchanges, they're up about, on average, about 22%. So these are big increases, and not what the president had promised the American people when he said the average family would see their premiums go down
right.
by $2,500 a year.
That's right. Steve, I want to note here, and I think we talked about this, premiums were rising and healthcare costs were rising before the Affordable Care Act. Sally's exactly right. President Obama said that was going to stop with the ACA.
And he was wrong. Basically, premiums have never really gone down year after year, kind of ever, mostly because medical technology costs always drive those pieces to go up. The question is, what's the percent increase? I think there was actually a slowdown in the rate of increase of premium, a little bit, at least the rate of cost, coming after the recession. A lot of people think that's the recession effect that came into play.
I see. Okay.
And that's now reversing. We're seeing in some of the data now. But in terms of the premium spike that Sally's talking about, that was predictable. I mean, I actually had written three separate Wall Street Journal articles about exactly that and when it would happen, with an October surprise starting, it was July, June of 14, December 14, July 15.
And you knew that was coming. Why?
Because there were regulations that were pulling off. The reinsurance piece was coming off. The risk corridor piece was pulling off. And this thing, the qualified health plan exemptions that allowed plans that were let the states essentially decide whether plans that were not in compliance with the law were more or less left to sort of exist through 2016.
So there were rules that were kind of buffering the premium increase, and they were starting to end.
Correct.
So we were getting the full Monty of the ACA, basically.
Right. I mean, everything came together as a bit of a tsunami, and I think what most people thought would happen is that there'd be enough take-up, it would be fine. I actually had an estimate. I was sort of kind of shouted out, at least in terms of comments, saying it was going to be about a 30% increase in certain instances. Now I look like I was, you know, under that.
No.
Greg says on Twitter, 24-year-old, $3,000 deductible for before any coverage begins. It's great coverage, but paying the deductible isn't an option. To the phones to Dan in Minneapolis. Hi, Dan. How's your health care work for you, your insurance?
It really doesn't. You know, you pay for your health care, but you don't have it. Ours is a $5,000 deductible per person and a $7,500 a year bill. And, you know, the fact of the matter is it's not working, and I didn't think it would, because the whole thing was designed to unload all the people off the government bill onto the working public. And that's what it was designed to do.
Dan, what do you mean when you say that?
Well, the government doesn't want to continually to pay for American public's health care. And that's what they were doing by the uninsured and the uninsurables and the unemployed. Mm. You take those three and then you stack that three columns up to the employed. And which one has more in the column? The employed people have less. And the uninsurables, the uninsured, the unemployed are more.
Sally, what do you think of that logic?
Well, I think, Dan, your caller, is right. People cannot, you know, people who are above the subsidy level, the 400% of the federal poverty level, who are eligible for subsidies, when they found out that, you know, what their premium increase was going to be, how much the premium was going to be per month on the silver benchmark plans, and then the deductible. And the deductible for 2017 on the bronze plan, which is the lowest price exchange plan for next year, is going to be about just over $6,000 for a family. It's $12,000, just over $12,000. People may have insurance, but people in the income bracket, say $100,000, $105,000 a family, they cannot afford these deductibles. I actually go beyond what Dan said and think the whole idea behind the Affordable Care Act was really to show that the Affordable Care Act was not going to work and was to move us down the path ultimately, to, as Hillary said during the campaign, and Obama came out recently to say, we need a public option, we need a public government insurance plan to compete with private insurers in the exchange. And then, ultimately, then, the private insurers would drop out. They couldn't compete. And then we would be on our path to a single-payer Medicare for all system, which I think was the ultimate goal.
Yeah, which won't happen now, since Donald Trump is going to be president. Here's what Donald Trump said to 60 Minutes yesterday about what he likes about the ACA and what he wants to do about it. Let's listen.
We're not going to have like a 2-day period, and we're not going to have a 2-year period where there's nothing. It will be repealed and replaced, and we'll know. And it'll be great health care for much less money. So it'll be better health care, much better, for less money. Not a bad combination.
Not a bad combination, Steve. If you can do it, how does he do that?
Oh, boy. Well,
yeah.
That was an inside sigh. There's a few ways you can do it. Not quite exactly that. You can probably lower the increase in premium if you pull off some of the regulatory factors that made things a little more expensive than otherwise.
Specifically what?
There's a ratio. We talked about this last time I was here. There's 3-to-1 ratio in terms of how big the spread is between the least premium and the biggest premium for depending on age. If you make that go from 3-to-1 to 5-to-1, that will decrease the cost substantially for folks that are younger. And actually, it might bring down the overall cost overall, because the adverse selection problem, the problem we've been having with the, if you will, the bad pool that's left behind,
right,
should reverse itself.
Okay. You'd get more younger, healthier people in.
Correct.
Because it would be more affordable to them.
Correct.
Okay.
So then come some interesting questions about better health care. Generally, Americans sort of think of better health care as they get to go see the doctor they want to go see. That might be possible. A lot of the high-deductible health plans have that. The challenge is going to be exactly when Dan was talking about others. Sally, the deductibles are too high to make them useful to someone in the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to need to have a different benefit design. Fortunately, there are a few things that have been swimming around. So, for example, there are services that are covered first dollar. If you have a high-deductible plan, you don't have to pay anything from your deductible. So visits for basically physicals, well child visits, immunization, some diagnostic testing.
So wellness kind of stuff.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's primary prevention.
Right.
One idea is to actually then pay at first dollar, pretty close to first dollar coverage, secondary prevention. And by that, it means that someone who has diabetes, someone who has asthma, the most common chronic conditions, would get their medications and some testing and procedures done basically for first dollar. So if that was possible, and it was allowed, because actually, I've been working on this for the last 2 or 3 years, and I know exactly where the stone walls are, and the stone walls are over now with this administration switch. You could have someone like Dan, if there's someone in the family or anyone's family who has a chronic condition, suddenly get something from these plans, and it won't hit your deductible.
And the insurers would go along with this. Why?
They would go along with it because it'd be allowed. Right now, it's illegal to actually have this design operate in the market. The IRS precludes it because secondary prevention is not considered an acceptable medical expense. This is something that literally has been a catch-22 myself and other folks on the left and the right have been going back and forth to between the administration and Congress, basically each one pointing the finger at each other. When one of you move, we'll go forward with that.
Sally, what do you think of that?
Well, no, I think it's a good idea. I think we have, you know, there's some other ideas out there, including, you know, the whole idea of, you know, if people keep their coverage continuous and renew it every year, then we will see, then those people who have pre-existing conditions will be able to, you know, keep their insurance and not face these tremendous tremendous increases that, you know, have happened in the past. So I think Steve is right. There's a lot of discussion out there, a lot of things that can be done to bring about affordable, accessible, quality care for everyone. And, you know, I think Donald Trump is right. I mean, the Affordable Care Act has been a disaster for the people that it was really designed to help. About 155 million Americans have employer-based coverage. And so those people, you know, have not been affected too adversely, although, you know, many are seeing that the cost of the premium, the portion that they have to pay of their premium has gone up. Their deductibles have gone up. Health savings accounts have come in and are becoming quite very popular among employer-based coverage because employers see them as a way to reduce their costs. And, of course, employees earn less money because they do get employer-based coverage.
Sally Pipes is one of our guests this morning as we talk about the Affordable Care Act and Donald Trump's varying proposals about repealing it, now keeping part of it, trying to manage the costs, the deductible issues here that we've been talking about, and what this looks like on the other side of Inauguration Day. She's the CEO of Pacific Research Institute and the author of The Way Out of Obamacare. And Steve Parente is with us. He's chair of the Health Finance Program at the Carlson School at the U of M. I'm asking you, as you join in on the conversation today, I'd like to know what you think works and doesn't work in your own health care plan. Now, this is whether you get it from your employer, whether you're on the exchanges, how you get your health care. Is the deductible too high? You basically don't use your as much health care as you'd like to. Are your choices too limited? How has the Affordable Care Act served you so far? Are there parts of it that you think ought to be maintained? And of course, I'm thinking about being able to keep a son or daughter on the on your insurance until they're 25 or 26 and some of the pre-existing condition issues. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieNPR, where Heidi says there's a problem when a family's insurance is higher than their mortgage. This is very common in South Dakota. Joe says, if I wrap my motorcycle around a tree, I need medical care, not insurance. And Ian says, we want health care, but we only have health insurance. There's a big difference. Steve, will you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, well, it's been part because it's politicized this way too. The issue about getting health care is just a question of how we operate in this country. Now, there, depending on your income, you can actually get it at a federal community health center.
Mm-hmm.
If you also, you can also get the Medicaid plans that are out there as well. If you're basically below 133% of the federal poverty line. So there are options available for folks that are in play. And much is covered by employer-sponsored coverage, but this is really just a function of how our country has decided to finance healthcare.
Meaning
that if you go to India, everything is self-pay. There is no insurance except for extreme instances or for expats that are over there and everything else like that. That's one reason why if you let it completely operate as a cash economy, suddenly you find that, say, cardiac bypass procedures are literally a third less for the same quality. And they're the same quality because it's our interns and residents going back and forth between the two countries.
To the phones to Allison in Lakeville. Hi, Allison. Thanks for waiting.
No problem.
How's this? How's the ACA working for you?
Well, I have an employer-sponsored plan, and it's awful. It's definitely the one thing that is almost crippling our family. We pay, $800 a month comes out of my check. And our deductibles are $3,000 per person, $4,000 per family. Probably by the time we meet the deductible, it'll start over. So we're basically paying out of pocket for everything. My daughter got stitches and it cost, it was in the evening. And so we had to end up going to the emergency room and mm-hmm. it cost so much money that now we have a payment plan set up with the hospital. So we have a payment for that. And there we have so many of these little things that happen that we have payment plans set up for doctor's bills, hospital bills. And that is, it's come to the decision, do we pay this payment this month or should we get some groceries?
Wow. So, Allison, just to be clear here, you get your health insurance from your employer, right? So you're not on the on the Affordable Care Act exchanges.
No. Nope.
You've raised
and
kind of
My husband also, they do offer that, and we've looked to changing to his, and it's basically the same amount of plan. I don't think it would be any better.
Okay. So Sally, to you on this, why is it that for all of the problems of the Affordable Care Act, people like Allison are not seeing a better situation from their employer-sponsored plans? What does that say about the whole system?
Well, as there's no question in my mind, Obamacare is in a death spiral. We've seen, the premiums up, the deductibles up. 17 out of the 23 co-ops that were set up under the Affordable Care Act have failed. A number of insurance companies are getting out of the market.
Okay, but that's the ACA.
In a few markets, she has employer-based coverage, and the reason that her costs are up is because the employers are having to pay you know, a lot more for the same coverage that they used to get, and it's because of the mandates that are on, you know, as part of the essential benefit plan. So and increased use, and so therefore employers are facing higher costs from the insurers, so they're passing that on to their employees.
Okay, wait a minute. You said a lot there. I want to make sure I understand what you said. Are you saying that the mandates of the Affordable Care Act have impacted insurers to the point where even when you're getting your health insurance through an employer, it's still expensive because of the way insurers have to interact with the ACA? Is that what
yes,
you said?
Exactly.
Steve, is that right?
Yeah, and there's another piece to it, too, that I think Sally's talking about, which is that there were pieces taking out the lifetime limit and also letting kids stay on their parents' plans till 26. They're popular. We heard in 60 Minutes that President Trump would like to keep those in there, President-elect Trump. But they do add dollars. I mean, what I would suggest, if people want to learn more about these things, adopt a healthcare actuary, make them your friend, take them out to dinner, learn their world, stare at their shoes, you stare at their shoes.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, that's what I've done in the research that I do, because it explains a lot. And so it's very challenging when these laws come to suddenly say, hey, what's the new premium impact going to be? Because the actuary's job, and they're obligated to do this for the insurance company, is to make sure that the insurance company, whether nonprofit or whatever, stays solvent. And so they have to be very risk averse in terms of what they're doing.
Okay.
And every time you basically jolt the system with a new mandate, they usually overcompensate. And what normally would be an actual cost of maybe, let's 3% more, could be as high as 10% more in premium just till we know how it's settled.
Got it.
And we've had a lot of this over the last 10 years.
Call
and
here.
I think, too, on the issue that you mentioned, children being able to stay on their parents' plans till age 26, there are about 5 million kids that are on their parents' insurance plans, but they've tended to be kids who have, you know, chronic or pre-existing conditions, so it's put a lot more pressure on the coverage.
Call here from John in Minneapolis. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Good morning. I'm, you know, listening to this conversation, and there's a lot of criticism of the Affordable Care Act and President Obama,
mm-hmm.
and we hear that a lot on the campaign trail about Minsure, and that's really such misdirected criticism. This is a failed insurance market. And it has been failed for a long time. And the Affordable Care Act was an attempt to kind of put some barriers around those market failures. But unfortunately, the market continued to fail. Prices continued to rise. The Affordable Care Act never actually addressed costs of health care. It was only how we pay for health care. And when you see all of these different pools of people who are covered, you have Medicare, you have Medicaid, you have Minnesota Care, you have employee-sponsored healthcare, you have the small group, and then you even have self-insured companies. And if you look at the Fortune 500 companies, even right here in Minneapolis, most of them have decided that the most efficient way to manage these costs is to self-insure. But then what do we see are, you know, with these increasing costs of healthcare, their costs also go up. It's an incredibly volatile market, which business people hate. CFOs do not like volatility in their expenses year to year. So our health care should not depend on our employment status or on our marital status, which is the current situation. We have to get health care out of the hands of business. And just like the Fortune 500 companies decided, it is more efficient to self-insure. That's why I support single payer, because mm-hmm. that puts all of us in one pool to create the most efficient spreading of those costs among us all. We already do that for the older and sicker among us, and young people like me pay those medical bills. Let's just do it at the whole pool, put us all together in one.
You, John, I really appreciate the call. You've brought up single payer, and I wanted to get to that. Steve?
Well, we have single payer in certain parts of the market. In the U.S., this looks as experiment. And I guess the question is, then we have single payer, do we see cost increases go down because of single payer management and pooling of resources?
Are you talking about Medicare?
Medicare.
Okay.
I'm talking about Medicare. I'm talking about the DOD program, TRICARE, which actually operates in a similar fashion.
This is for veterans, yeah.
Well, not for veterans. It's for active duty personnel and their kids and things like that. There's roughly about 3 million people total in that plan. It's run by private insurers or delegated out. I do want to make sure a few things are very clear about things. When we talk about single payer, the private insurance market is still involved in Medicare. Medicare itself as a program does not pay one claim. It's delegated out to private insurers under contract to run the Medicare program, always was since 1967. Yeah. So let's make sure we're really clear when we say let's blow up private insurance. First of all, let's put that off the table, because if you do that, no one's getting paid at all. We're basically self-paying. Second piece is that when we have single-payer experiments, for lack of a better term, in different segments of the market, it doesn't slow the rate of inflation. If anything, there are moments where we try different things to try to fix it, and things eke out the other way. We, for example, have an explosion in outpatient hospital services right now that's come by Medicare trying to rein in inpatient, while physicians got very ingenious and decided to do everything on the outside.
Steve and Sally, come in on this. I thought Medicare had actually done a decent job in controlling the acceleration of costs. That, yes, indeed, costs were still going up, but that they weren't going up as quickly as on the rest of the market. Steve, that's not true, it sounds like.
They were, in the last, say, 6 or 7 years, that might have been true, but that was true for the entire health economy, and it was mostly a recession effect.
Okay. And Sally, on the idea of single payer.
As a former Canadian who grew up under single payer, I'm very much anti-single payer. Canada is one of three countries in the world that has a true single payer system. Mm-hmm. As a result, government has to cut back on what they pay out. So they do that by rationing care. People have long waiting lists. The average Canadian today waits 18.3 weeks, over 4 months, from seeing primary care doc to treatment by a specialist. We have a real single payer system in this country, and it's the Veterans Administration. And, you know, look, we've seen all the problems with waiting lists, lack of access to some of the newest drugs under the VA formulary. So it has not been, the single payer in the VA has not been working for patients, and that's definitely clear today. We saw in Vermont, Governor Shumlin signed a single payer bill into law a couple of years ago. He had to pull back on that. They couldn't afford it, the tax cost. And Colorado just defeated handily Amendment 69, which would have brought single payer to Colorado. It is not a program that is in the best interest of patients and of America.
A conversation this morning, if you've just gotten in with us, with Steve Parente and Sally Pipes about what repeal and reforming the Affordable Care Act looks like. Does it solve a lot of the issues that people are encountering when they go on these state exchanges with when you take your health care through your employer? Are costs still going to rise? We're hearing some perspective on that. What would it take to solve some of the biggest problems of the Affordable Care Act? What does it mean for the quality and the cost of health care overall? We're talking about that as well. And I want to hear from you, and we are this morning, this is good, about what works and what doesn't in your own health care plan. You've talked to me this morning about deductibles. You've talked to me about choices. You've suggested some things you think would be better. How has the Affordable Care Act served you so far? 800-242-2828. If you get a busy signal, call us back. 651-227-6000. Steph is hanging out at nprnews.org/live. And I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Here's one of the things I want to do on the other side of news. Donald Trump was on 60 Minutes in 2015. And he talked about how he believes that everybody has to be covered. So he's suggesting some kind of a mandate. And I want to talk about that mandate on the other side of news. But first to Phil Picardi. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. President-elect Donald Trump is considering oil billionaire Harold Hamm and North Dakota Congressman Kevin Cramer to lead the Department of Energy. Trump is also considering venture capitalist Robert Grady for the top energy job. That's according to a transition planning document obtained by the Associated Press. Grady, who worked in the first President Bush's administration, is also listed on the document as a possible pick to lead the Interior Department. The planning document includes several energy and environmental priorities for the next administration, including repealing the Clean Power Plan. The plan was introduced by the Obama administration and aims to limit carbon pollution from power plants. Top EU diplomats who are worried about Donald Trump's isolationist and protectionist promises are calling for a more robust European defense and a greater European voice in world affairs. Today, those diplomats joined defense ministers to discuss cooperation with NATO, whose future is uncertain after Trump suggested that Washington could abandon its NATO commitments. Hundreds of people may have to be rescued by helicopter following a powerful earthquake in New Zealand. Military helicopters and a Navy ship are headed to a coastal town where about 1,000 tourists and hundreds of residents remain stranded following the 7.8 magnitude jolt that cut off train and vehicle access and triggered a small tsunami. Greece is getting ready for a two-day visit by President Obama. He is due in Athens tomorrow before heading to Berlin the next day. The stops are part of a major trip abroad. Anarchist and leftist groups are planning protest marches during the visit. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:36.
Weekdays on All Things Considered, the latest news from around the world and across the state. I'm Tom Cran. What's happening and why? Join me for the latest here on Minnesota Public Radio News, starting at 3.
Okay, along with everything that we're doing on the election and the policy questions, it is also Thread Week on the show. So it's all about big books and big ideas. I urge you to check out the Thread page, nprnews.org/thread. I'll give you all of your great reading list, great books, all the way through the end of the year, right there on the Thread.
Support for this program comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
Back to the conversation this hour. Steve Parente in the studio with me from the Carlson School. Sally Pipes with us from the Pacific Research Institute. And a call here from Beth in St. Francis. Hi, Beth. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Boy, I have a ton of questions.
Well, if you will please limit them. Yes.
I'll stick to this one.
Okay.
I feel like there's a bit of a bait and switch going on here. We certainly don't seem to have any shortage of ideas on how the ACA could be improved and made perhaps a lot better. And I'm wondering how many of these changes have been proposed, but simply because we have a Congress for the last 8 years that refused to give President Obama any successes. I mean, they just came out and said so. How many of these changes are we going to see take place now so Donald Trump and the Republican administration can go ahead and say, see, we were right. You know, they're going to repeal it and replace it with the same thing, just with the fixes that should have been taking place all along?
Yeah, Beth, this is a really good question, because off air we were just talking about where Congress would fit in here. Yeah, so Sally, will you speak to that first? What do you think Congress is going to come to the table with for this?
Well, I think, as you know, we have a Republican president-elect, and the Republicans held the House and the Senate. They have the Senate, but not with the 60-vote majority, with, you know, 51 votes. So I think definitely, as we said earlier, the voters in the exit polls and prior to in all the polling up to the election over the last, you know, sort of 6 years, you know, the range has been 54-55% of Americans as the Affordable Care Act went into being, wanted to see the legislation repealed and replaced. So going forward, I think, you know, Trump promised that he would repeal and replace disastrous Obamacare. I think we'll see probably after inauguration on January 20th, repeal coming through reconciliation, because in that way they only need 51 votes.
Right,
to
but
repeal.
But Sally, I'm asking you for actual. I get the political process here. I'm asking
right.
you for what ideas Congress is going to bring for reworking healthcare.
Sure. Well,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I think they're going to bring forward ideas such as Trump has talked about block granting Medicaid, so the states can decide
okay.
how to run their Medicaid programs,
mm-hmm.
allowing people to buy coverage across state lines. The insurance companies don't like this, but I think, you know, it's something that's out there, and I think it's going to be looked into. Increasing the amount of the deductible for health savings accounts, and as Trump said, being able to leave the money in your HSA account to your next of kin and let that move forward tax-free, getting rid of the individual and the employer mandates. We'll see, I think, removal of the essential benefit plan, which adds 20-50% to the cost of premiums. I think we'll see tort reform pushed. I don't like it at the federal level. I think the state should do it, but I think there'll be discussion for sure on the high cost of medical malpractice insurance and how that pushes up up the cost of health care.
Okay, wait, Sally, just 1 minute if you would, because you're running down like a 10-item list here.
Sorry.
That's okay. Let me come back to this block granting on Medicaid, Steve. What's the upside of that for controlling costs?
Medicaid actually works really well to control costs. So when I do microsimulation modeling, Medicaid or Medicaid managed care actually does really well. In part, it's a narrow network. There's pre-negotiated prices. The prices are the providers get. They do the same services for the least price, ideally close to marginal cost.
And so we could scale that up to...
Well, it already is scaled up. That's where the success of getting people covered for ACA has come from, is through Medicaid expansion. So what Sally's talking about in terms of the block grant program would probably do is probably take some of the money that's been allocated for the expansion, probably a little bit less, maybe change the eligibility parameters, but basically go to the states and say, you now have this amount of money to work with, innovate how you want to do it. Now, what's interesting about this is that I assume, Sally, when we talk about that, we're talking about all states, as long as the budget doesn't blow up to do this. And so the states who have not come in for expansion already suddenly can come in. So there's
there
a lot.
19,
so Texas states or something
have not expanded their programs.
Okay.
Right. So like Texas, right. Other places can come in, but it has to be done in a way that doesn't blow up the federal budget. Has to have states come in with the innovation and authority to sort of take the responsibility of doing this in a reasonable way. The good news about this is that if there have been positive, if you will, experiments from ACA on the Medicaid side, is that many private carriers that actually sort of scaled up to handle the Medicaid expansion have done it in a national way, meaning that they could come and service this market pretty well. Every one of those states, Texas and otherwise, who hasn't come in on the expansion can easily sort of take advantage of that.
So, Steve, also, Sally mentioned the mandate, which is something I wanted to get to here. Here's Donald Trump on 60 Minutes in 2015 with Scott Pelley talking about the need for universal care.
Everybody's got to be covered. This is an un-Republican thing for me to say, because a lot of times they say, no, the lower 25%, they can't afford private. But
universal health care.
I am going to take care of everybody. I don't care if it costs me votes or not. Everybody's going to be taken care of much better than they're taken care of now.
The uninsured person is going to be taken care of.
They're going to be taken care of.
How?
I would make a deal with existing hospitals to take care of people. And you know what? This is probably...
Make a deal. Who pays for it?
The government's going to pay for it, but we're going to save so much money on the other side.
Steve, does that make sense?
It makes sense given where Donald Trump comes from. So if you go way back, keep in mind, Donald Trump is a New Yorker. The notion of actually having New York government pooling with hospitals and covering everybody goes back to the 1930s. It existed. But that's not how the way most of the country operates because of the way the private insurance evolved in the roughly 70 years since that. So I kind of get where he's coming from just culturally to start with.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, when he has advocated it, and I think Sally and I saw the same tweet stream that we tried to piece together what would be a Donald Trump policy prior to his website in March this year, he did advocate basically NHS Scotland as a model too. That's a single payer system. The problem with this is that, you know, it's him trying to respond to the notion, I think, that he honestly believes that everybody should be covered. The question is, how do you do that in a reasonable way? Now, the truth is that as a safety net, block granting Medicaid is a way to achieve that aim, actually. And then the question is, from there on up, for the less vulnerable, how do we do it in a way that makes sense given we're running a market economy?
Some of these are people that are getting subsidies. They're not in that. They're not below poverty level, but they're up above on the income, and they're getting subsidies, right? Some of these families through these exchanges.
Correct.
What happens to them?
I think the best template right now to look at on the Congress side is what Paul Ryan put through is a better way plan, because it actually has most of all the elements that Sally talked about. Including tort reform. It talks about the block granting provisions. It talks about actually having subsidies that are available. I've modeled this for them, specifically that staff.
Uh-huh.
And those subsidies are not tied to income as much as they're tied to age. So
right.
It directly tries to deal with the individual mandate problem, which is, well, how do we actually get the younger folks to come in and the older folks? We actually subsidize the premium where it helps the most in terms of getting them into the market.
And these are the youngest?
And the oldest.
Okay.
And the folks that are it's actually saying for someone who is, say, 55 years old, you're going to, in a certain income category perhaps, you're going to get a subsidy that's going to be about, say, $6,500 to $7,000. That's more than potentially what they're getting right now.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're younger, just to get on a bronze plan, we're going to give you, say, only $1,500. We're also going to deregulate the market so that, that those premiums will be less to you, so that dollar will go further.
Selling? And you can get the kind of plan that, that you actually would want to have when you're young and healthy.
Which would mean that you don't have coverage necessarily that you're not going to need.
Correct.
Which is something that the ACA did.
Correct.
Didn't it?
And here's the other thing. The thing I mentioned about secondary prevention, you're going to have some young, healthy individuals that still might have asthma. Well, it'd be good if their meds were maybe covered. Mm-hmm. If that's only going to increase premiums by 5 or 6%, which is what we modeled it out to be, and the actuaries don't freak out about it and make it 15, then that actually everybody gets advantage from that.
Stuff off the page.
Josh is frustrated by the fact that no one in the industry knows the basic cost for medical care. He says, ask what a blood test costs, pap smear, broken arm. The business plan of health care is a shell game. And Krista says, I have a 4-year-old daughter who had a stroke. She needs ongoing rehab and therapy. I keep having to switch from facility to facility every year with new ACA coverage because my health care plan needs to change.
Steve, on that first comment.
He's right. To actually find what prices are actually paid, you need to be someone like me who has a lot of data.
It's infuriating, let me tell you.
But
transparency.
Right. One of the hats that I wear is I'm the chair of this thing called the Healthcare Cost Institute. We're trying to open this data up. The insurers are actually supporting us with this. There's a tool out there called Guru, G-U-R-O-O, .com. It's free. You can actually see care bundles. And actually, if you drill down a little bit, you can see just, if nothing else, the spread. In for the exact same service for the same providers that you're seeing there. So that test might have literally a 3-to-1 spread in payment for the exact same test.
It, depending on where you are in the country or just between healthcare providers?
Between health providers in the same part of the country.
What the heck? Why?
Because of negotiations that the plans do with the providers.
Okay.
And this is literally, Carrie, a blood sport that goes on between the insurers and the hospitals and the physician group practices on a weekly basis. On a weekly basis.
Sally, and you've seen this as well. You live in California. You've seen this as well there, of course.
Yes, absolutely. And it's transparency is something that the president had promised. We would see price transparency.
That's
In fact, it hasn't worked.
Melissa says on Twitter, I disagree with the comments regarding VA health care. VA provides low-cost, high-quality care. The news reports were overblown. Let's see. Mike says, is employer-based health insurance the best, or should we push 100% of America into individual markets? You know, Sally, I asked Steve this last time he was in, that among others, Zeke Emanuel was here predicting that within, I think he said, 10 years at the most, we would all be separated from our employer health insurance plans. Do you think that's true?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think, you know, the reason that 60% of Americans have employer-based coverage is because during World War II, when wage and price controls were in, employers were having a hard time attracting new people and better people. And so they were given the opportunity to provide employer-based coverage, and employees get their health care tax-free. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, their salary would be slightly lower. But this is wrong. We don't get our long-term care, our house insurance, our car insurance through our employer. And I would like to see it disentangled. Also, for people in the individual market who go out to buy coverage, they can't buy their health insurance tax-free. We need to, I think, first allow individuals to write off the tax of their coverage. And if we work towards getting a market-based health care plan, ultimately the goal would be for everybody to have their coverage individually based. The risk pool would be much larger, and it would you know, bring costs down.
Yeah, you know, Sally, I was reading your plan, and you say that the ACA ignoring the tax implications of this was one of the big misses of the Affordable Care Act. Can you just explain why?
Well, I think because the whole idea of employer-based coverage, I mean, it sounds good, but it's what we call first dollar coverage. So, and so people overuse something they think that it's free or it's very cheap, and that's been the way it's been until the ACA, and now employees are saying their coverage go up, as we talked about earlier.
Right. So if Congress were to change that, I'm somebody who gets my health insurance through Minnesota Public Radio. If they change the tax rules on this, what could that potentially mean?
Well, it would mean that that
if you decided that you didn't want to have your coverage through your employer or you wanted to go out into the individual market, you could buy the kind of coverage that suits your needs and those of your family, and you would be able to write off.
Okay.
It would be tax-free.
The way I do this through NPR, that I am not paying taxes on
right.
the health care benefits that NPR, but if you're out there on the open market, you are.
And NPR should pay you more because you're not burdening the system.
You're
so
listening, NPR?
You should make more money and have more money to pay to buy private coverage.
I like the way
coverage.
You think, Sally. That's great. Steve, you're going to say.
Yeah, this is actually one of the things we've talked about for a long time. If you get rid of the tax deductibility, what will firms do? Certainly, they probably will see it as an advantage to maybe get out. It might be their moment that they've been waiting to basically be liberated. There's a question of how people then deduct that. How they deduct that program, that not everybody will be able to deduct it quite the same way. I will say one thing, that there's a study that I have coming out in a book with another professor, a friend of mine, Chuck Phelps, where we actually model removing the entire tax exclusion.
Oh, uh-huh.
But our thought experiment is not then to use it to pay for other health care. It's to actually use it to lower marginal tax rates across the board. And we actually model, working with some other economists in Minnesota that are macroeconomists, that it would lead to about a 1% productivity boost. Thus, you could actually improve the economy of the U.S. tremendously if you just pull off really is what is the largest tax subsidy, bigger than mortgage, that's in the United States today.
Sally, do you buy that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a terrific idea and a great extension to moving forward.
Lisa says on Twitter, shopping for care is a myth. We have one choice in our rural community. We know that that's the case in a lot of communities, Steve.
It is definitely the case in a lot. And actually, when you look at the Guru website, we do break Minnesota out by different regions, and you'll see that the rural regions are more expensive than the metro regions.
And also to add that, Sally.
In five states that are covered by the exchanges, there's only one plan available. And remember, in Arizona,
right.
up until recently, there was going to be no plan for people in Pinal County. So, you know, I mean, that really sort of, you know, less competition is not a good thing, because we were promised more competition and more choices.
Mark says block granting Medicaid would result in deep cuts to services for people with disabilities like me. Dane says the CEO of United Health makes $66 million. Nonprofit, quote-unquote, Allina CEO makes $4 million. Neither provide patient care. Executive greed is the problem. Steve, is that part of the issue? What we're paying the CEOs of these insurers?
It may be, but this is a problem that goes across corporate America. I mean, it's up to the insurance companies to decide whether they want to be for-profit or not profit. Some Blue Cross plans actually convert to for-profit. There doesn't seem to be much of an outcry when, say, Empire Blue Cross, which was non-profit for all of New York City, goes for-profit with Anthem. I don't think that's going to basically fix the problem. It is additional money. But, I mean, the reality is United Health Group is operating a very rich constellation of services.
Mm-hmm.
A good chunk of the Medicaid program is being serviced by United Healthcare. A good chunk of the Medicare program in the United States is being serviced by United Healthcare. It's not just the individual insurance market. It's not just exchanges, and it's not just Medicare. Most of AARP's contracts outside of Humana, which is also for-profit, is coming out of United Healthcare. So to manage something that complex, it looks like GE. That's how they're modeling themselves.
Steph, off the page.
Lori says, we're paying $1,000 per month for our health insurance. We've got a $7,000 deductible per person. We can no longer afford to see the doctor. Plus, they're cheating us out of our well visits. If you bring up anything that's not on the checklist, you get charged for extra appointments. And despite what you say, Sally, that Lori then adds, single payer.
Okay. To Michael in Minneapolis. Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for waiting.
It's a pleasure. I think I'm always reminded that this whole healthcare debate, when the Democratic Congress and President Obama put it together, was at a time when it was kind of a mix of whether we could be just purely optimistic and moving forward. So now we know what the blowback is. And I think on this issue and any issue related to what the new Republican side is going to do should always be who's going to win, who's going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
It happens to be in our family that we benefit from the kind of the World War II health package that was actually is an incentive for my wife to work where she does, which is we feel very lucky. But I think what Steve is saying is really fascinating, and I'm going to certainly look at his website, and I hope that he'll blog and let us all know where are the upsides and the downsides of all these changes. And I hope that in all of your policy discussions on other issues, that'll be something we walk away every time, just saying who the winners and who the losers are going to be, because clearly there are a lot of them.
I appreciate the frame, and I'll keep that in mind. Downside, Steve, if you would weigh on some of these changes. Fewer people insured, is that one of the key?
Potentially. I mean, I've modeled the Ryan plan. You can go to a website, Center for Health and Economy, or healthandeconomy.org. So that shows at least for the modeling pieces. So Ryan's plan, as structured, would actually insure at least initially 1 million people more.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost would be a little bit less. But basically what's happening is we're relying upon some of the Medicaid innovations to take better hold for stock for block granting. And there's also some Medicare reform that's in Ryan's plan, too, and that will save some money as well.
Exactly. Some of the means testing, the premium support, the raising the age, because when Medicare came into being 51 years ago, the average person lived to, you know, age 65. Today, that average American lives to 79. And so, and there's a lot of people out there who could well afford to get individual coverage.
HSAs
should be extended.
I want to be clear here, Sally. So you are saying that Ryan's plan factors in savings from the means testing and raising the age for Medicare.
Exactly.
Well, that's a big, huge assumption.
Well, I modeled it. I mean, I actually count the dollars up for doing this. And we don't show that it's that big a savings, just so we're clear.
Saying getting that politically through Congress that you can means to get a plan to means test Medicare?
Sally said it. It's called reconciliation.
Yeah.
It's all budget. So here's the way reconciliation works. If it involves a deficit, if it involves spending, if it involves tax revenue, it is allowable under reconciliation on a 51 vote.
This is how the Obama administration got some things through.
This is how you're going to see repeal and replace happen before June of this year.
Sally,
that's
happen.
How Obamacare was passed.
Right.
March 23rd, 2010 through reconciliation with not a single Republican voting on the Senate or the House side.
Remember it well. Hey, Sally, thank you so much. Really good to have you on the show. Hope you'll come back.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Sally Pipes is the author of The Way Out of Obamacare. Steve, you were going to add something on that.
Yeah, just I guess the one thing about it is that although it did not get with one Republican vote, the hope is even if reconciliation occurs, is that maybe a few Democrats will come along. And the reason why I would like to see that happen if it goes this way is that we need to get out of this mire of having this bill be so partisan that it doesn't go anywhere. We need to have the bill finally arc at least closer to the way Social Security, Medicare, and other things happened that
the
were bipartisan.
The administration thought that was going to happen. Though, didn't it? Remember? They thought people would get used to having, you know, different health care, having more people insured.
Right.
But that didn't happen.
It didn't happen for a lot of reasons. I circulated around the Hill at the time. I saw what some of the Republican senators did, why they wanted to hole up the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
A part of it was, I think, that the actually one interesting interpretation is that one reason why it didn't happen was that the lion of the Senate, if you will, Ted Kennedy had passed. And Kennedy would have insisted on the vote actually getting some Republicans along before it went up for vote.
Yeah.
But he had passed away.
Steve, thank you. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you, Carrie.